Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Catechesis. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict returns to a series of catecheses on prayer by looking at Psalm 3, where the psalmist urged God to rescue him from the enemies who surround him. Dignity of mothers. Why is a reduction in maternal mortality the most neglected of the 8 Millennium Development Goals? We discover the reasons why by talking to Catholic obstetricians at a conference sponsored by the Pontifical Academy for Life. 9/11, the day the world changed. A New York-based Jesuit priest and author of a book about his ministry at Ground Zero following the attacks shares with us his recollections of that fateful day and discusses whether we have learnt the right lessons from the tragedy. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict returned to a series of catecheses on prayer by looking at Psalm 3, where the psalmist cries out to God to rescue him from the enemies who surround him. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
God is always near, even in difficulties, problems, and in the darkness of life. He listens, responds, and saves us in his own way. But we must be able to recognize his presence and accept his ways. This was Pope Benedict XVI's lesson this Wednesday, as he introduced Psalm number 3, also known as the Psalm of David, as the subject of his 7th General Audience dedicated to the Christian School of Prayer. To the joy of 20,000 visitors and pilgrims to the Vatican, the Pope returned to St. Peter's Square for his weekly catechesis for the first time since the July break and the August sessions held in the cooler courtyard of his summer residence in the Roman Hills. A gentle breeze brought some relief to those gathered in a humid stone square beneath a hot midday sun, but even the unusually warm September weather failed to dampen their enthusiastic welcome to Pope Benedict as he toured the square in his Popemobile.
Dear brothers and sisters, traditionally the psalm is attributed to King David as he flees from the armies of his rebellious son Absalom. Assailed on every side by foes who seek his life, the psalmist calls on the name of the Lord, filled with faith in the presence and the power of God, who alone can save him from the evils that threaten him.
Earlier in his comments in Italian, the Pope developed on the importance of remaining firm in our faith in the Lord, even in the midst of desperation. He said the enemy's aggression of the psalmist is not only physical, but touches on the spiritual dimension. It is the very temptation to which the believer is subjected, the temptation to lose faith, faith in the nearness of God. This temptation, he said, is the last attack of the enemy, and one we must resist. Only then will we find God and find life.
And yet we know that God truly hears the prayers of those who call upon him in faith. Even so, Jesus appears to be abandoned by the Father as he dies on Calvary. Yet for the eyes of faith, it is a crowning moment of salvation, the triumph of the cross, the hour of our Savior's glorification.
Pope Benedict concluded his lesson with a prayer.
Commending all of you to the intercession of St. Peter and Paul, I invoke God's blessings upon you. Thank you.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Improving women's health by reducing maternal mortality is the most neglected of the 8 Millennium Development Goals. Experts say at the present rate of progress, it will take 275 years to reach the 2015 millennium goal of reducing maternal mortality by 3/4. But why is progress lagging so badly behind in this particular sector? What steps need to be taken to save the lives of more mothers? And how can the church better serve the culture of life when it is so often under attack in the international medical community? These were among the issues being discussed at the recent conference held by MaterCare International, that's an association of Catholic obstetricians and gynaecologists dedicated to improving the lives and health of mothers and their newborn and unborn children. Dr. Robert Wally is the founder and director of MaterCare International and is himself a professor in obstetrics and gynaecology.
Looking at the Millennium Development Goals, the one that's lagging most behind targets is improving women's health, particularly by reducing maternal mortality by 75% by the year 2015. Why are we lagging so far behind on this?
The sin of omission. You know, you can do violence two ways. One is by commission, what you physically do to somebody. But also we forget that you can cause violence by omission, that the issue is not important enough for everybody to put their efforts into. So in other words, and also because motherhood is of no political importance, maternal mortality is not terribly politically important, and mothers, even in East Africa and West Africa, which I know well, they're optimistic when they're having a baby. They're not expecting to die, even though they're delivering in their huts without anybody to help them. And so they're not clamouring for a proper trained person to help them, for clean, dignified places in which to deliver. They think this is fine. And so, unfortunately and sadly, around the world, 330,000 of them die every year. And when you're dead, the only voice available are yours and mine and the listeners.
And most of these maternal deaths are occurring in sub-Sahara Africa, is that right? What percentage?
The majority. The greatest need is in sub-Saharan Africa, right across from west to east. There are many maternal deaths in India and other poor countries, but also anywhere else where there's civil strife and military problems and disasters, for example, like Haiti. But on an ongoing basis and without any signs of improvement, it's in East Africa.
So you say without any signs of improvement. It hasn't improved at all over the last 20 years?
Not really, no. And the simple reason is there have been no funds, there's been no political need, there's no been pressure. The international community haven't bothered to provide the wherewithal to go in and provide the healthcare to mothers. And when we first went by invitation from the bishop of the then Bishop of Isiolo, Monsignor Locati, what I found was really basically nothing in the rural areas. We had to start, and we are working from scratch. But you find that the least generous of groups to help you are governments. The next least generous are the corporate sector. The most generous are ordinary people who will give what they can from their pensions into the collection on Sunday through donations which we raise. Then there comes foundations. And in particular, I have to say that the church in Italy, the bishops, have been most generous and most supportive of the work we've been doing. When we met here in 2001, the late Holy Father, Blessed John Paul II, said about us as obstetricians, around the world, Catholic obstetricians, I know how difficult it is for you. I know the pressures that you've been under, but please, the church has never needed you as it does now so much. And please, don't give up.
Coming back to these maternal mortality rates, as you say, that really haven't moved much in this sub-Saharan Africa, how does that compare to how they've improved in the West over the last 20, 30, 40 years?
Okay, let me just say, the World Health Organization, up until last year, were saying that there were 600,000 mothers die every year. The problem with that is there's no reliable statistics of births, deaths and causes and sex and all that kind of stuff. So no records. Last year in The Lancet, one of the foremost medical journals, there was a well-researched study published which shows, after they had looked at 181 countries, that the maternal mortality, particularly in developing countries, had fallen. And it was down to 330,000. And the reason for that is those countries had provided essential obstetrics. What's been happening with the international community and the big organizations, population organizations, is they've been promoting reproductive health. But when we know, as obstetricians, that the majority of the deaths take place in the last 3 months of pregnancy, during labor and delivery, and then 1 week afterwards, birth control, abortion are irrelevant medically. What everybody needs there is what everybody gets here in Italy, is a trained person to look after them, clean, safe delivery, place where you can be treated for life-threatening complications. And that's all we're trying to do, to make sure that working with the bishops and our colleagues there to try and improve access, but taking the hospital facilities, if you like, nearer to where the mother is, not the other way, by having the great hospital on the hill and the mother has to kind of crawl there when there are no roads.
She's already in labour.
And she's in labour, or she's hemorrhaging, and she's got to get there on the back of a motorbike or walk even. So we started with this concept back in the mid-90s or early 90s in Nigeria and then Ghana, trying to build a model of rural essential obstetrics. You know, pregnancy is not a disease, but sadly things do go wrong. And so with all the trained people, with facilities and so on, we've reduced the maternal deaths almost to zero. Some places it's a bit patchy if you're in a rural area, even in Canada or the US. But basically, it's way down. Nothing like it is in places like Isiolo.
In which country is this?
This is Kenya. In the rural areas, maybe 1 in 15 will die. Even worse, the refugee camps or in Haiti. During the time of the earthquake, mothers were delivering in indescribable conditions.
In the streets.
Absolutely. And our view is that when there's a terrible crisis of this kind, everybody seems to kind of forget that you can't simply put motherhood on hold.
If a baby has to be born.
Yeah, and it's right that the immediate thing, they bring in water and blankets and tents and so on, and that's fine. That's important. I have no quarrel with that. But they fail to provide for maternal health. And the tragedy everywhere has been that they don't survive. For simple things that could be corrected. If only there was the political will, there was the compassion, there were the finances, and so on. We are trying to fight the issue that mothers need exactly what we want for us in the rich world, what we want for ourselves. But we seem to only want for them is abortion and birth control, which is more death and despair on top of what they got already.
So do you find a lot of resistance in terms of trying to get funds, trying to get political interest in this issue?
Absolutely. It comes from the major funding agencies of the European Union, of Great Britain, of Canada and the US. And whatever the politicians say, that it's middle management in these agencies that will block and do exactly what they want. So, for example, the Canadian Prime Minister chaired the G8, G20 conferences in 2010. He said the focus of my presidency will be to provide maternal health care, develop maternal health care according to the needs of the MDG, but without abortion. He got castigated. And so faith-based agencies, both in Canada and the US, are being discriminated against because we do not provide reproductive health care, because as professional obstetricians, we believe it's irrelevant. And our job is to stop the mothers dying.
Another participant at the MaterCare conference was Dr. Donna Harrison from Michigan, who's a member of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She talks about the medical reasons why women still die nowadays as a result of pregnancy or childbirth complications.
We know why women die in pregnancy and childbirth. They need obstetrical care when they're delivering. They need safe place to deliver, they need skilled birth attendants, and they need the medicines, like drugs that cause the uterus to contract, and antibiotics to take care of them. And they need another drug called magnesium sulfate, which is very cheap, and that treats hypertension in pregnancy. Those are the major killers of women in pregnancy and in delivery. And these are cheap and easy to provide. But we don't have a commitment from the world to treat the women who are pregnant. Instead, the world says, well, we'll just eliminate pregnancy. We'll provide abortion so that they don't have a child to deliver. I worked in Haiti with an indigenous organization. We were doing community-based health care. And what I can tell you is that a lot of women who came to see us were malnourished and anemic. So in addition to going into pregnancy anemic, these women also faced massive challenges in even getting to the clinic. Some of them had to walk for miles to get to the clinic, and some of them even had to walk for miles in labor. So the major issues they face were nutrition, malaria, malnutrition, and hemorrhage and infection.
I was speaking to Dr. Donna Harrison, an American pro-life obstetrician, and earlier you heard the voice of Dr. Robert Wally, founder and director of MaterCare International. September the 11th, 2001, is one of those dates indelibly stamped in the memory and psyche of all Americans who are old enough to remember that fateful day a decade ago. Just as when President Kennedy was shot at Dallas, everyone remembers what he or she was doing when the attacks occurred. 9/11 is often described as the day the world changed. But how did it change us as individuals and our view of others? And what are some of its most lasting and perhaps most disturbing legacies? Father James Martin is a Jesuit priest and prize-winning author who's the culture editor for America magazine. He published a book entitled Searching for God in Ground Zero that described his experience of ministering to firemen and rescue workers at the site of the collapsed Twin Towers in New York City in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. Father James began by sharing with me his personal recollections of how the events unfolded after two hijacked planes flew into the towers on that sunny September morning 10 years ago.
Well, I first got a call from my mother in Philadelphia who told me that the World Trade Center had been hit by a plane, and I didn't believe her, or I thought, why is she calling me? She knows I, you know, don't work anywhere near there. I'm uptown, not downtown. When I turned on the TV set, I was horrified, like everybody else, and then quickly rushed outside and could see down 6th Avenue. Our building is right on 6th Avenue. The towers aflame, and could see the black smoke pouring out of the tops of the towers. It was horrifying.
And what was the reaction of people around you at that particular moment?
Absolute shock. You know, there had been in the 1930s or 1940s an airplane that had crashed into the Empire State Building, and that, you know, people have seen pictures of that, but nothing of this scale had ever happened. And of course, everyone was worried that it was the first volley of a war. I think many people grasping for an image were thinking of Pearl Harbor and wondered if this was the beginning of an all-out assault on American soil.
And then I gather you went to a doctor's appointment that day, and then after you got back, you were told by somebody in your office that one of the Twin Towers had collapsed. Wasn't that right?
Yes, I had a doctor's appointment, and like many New Yorkers, wasn't really clear on the extent of the damage, and so I went about my business, and by the time I came back, as you say, our receptionist said that one of the towers had collapsed, and I actually got angry with her, and I said, you know, why are you listening to that stuff? That's ridiculous. And turned on the television and was shocked. I could not believe it. I could not believe that something so massive had just disintegrated. It was a nightmare.
Okay, so you went to try to minister for survivors, didn't you? Tell us a little bit about that. But of course, there weren't many survivors, as we know.
Well, that night I walked over to a local hospital hoping to help out. I walked in with my collar on and was told to go further downtown to a place called Chelsea Piers, a kind of converted sports arena, where they were waiting for the survivors. And at that point, as you said, there were lots of survivors expected, and no one came. And so it was a very grim and sad and quiet night. It was also very quiet in the city. There were no cars or trucks, as I recall. I walked through the empty streets that night to this place called Chelsea Piers.
2 days later, you ended up going to the Ground Zero site to minister to firefighters, police officers, and the other rescue personnel working there. You, in fact, even wrote a book about your experience there. Can you describe it for us? I mean, the site must have been hellish.
Hellish is a good word. I think that the only thing that I could compare it to were movies and films that I had seen of bombed out cities in Europe during World War II. I got into a police car in a relatively unscathed part of town, Midtown, and within a few minutes, maybe. We started driving through parts of town that were covered with ash. There were big pieces of debris and paper all over the ground. And when we pulled up to the site, it was basically a disaster area covered with ash, still smoking. The huge remains of the World Trade Center still sticking straight out of the ground, and hundreds of people in uniforms milling about. It was chaos and bedlam. And at the same time, I was aware that I was standing in front of a huge mass grave. So the rapidity with which I went from a relatively normal New York neighborhood to hell really made my head spin.
But tell us a little bit about the rescue staff that were working there. You said that although it was hell, you found grace there.
I would say it was one of the most profound experiences of the Holy Spirit that I've ever had. And that may sound odd coming from someone who's talking about Ground Zero, but for me it was the Christian mystery of the resurrection. When I was there ministering to firefighters, rescue workers, police officers, all I encountered was this great sense of charity and helpfulness and unity and compassion. Everyone wanted to know how I was doing. Everyone was other-directed. Everyone was pouring themselves out for their fellow human being. And of course, their sacrifices were all informed by the great sacrifice that happened just a few days before when the firefighters rushed into the burning building. So there we were standing in front of this great sign, in a sense, of other people's love for one another, the firefighters who had rushed into the burning buildings, as well as people's great hatred for one another, the people that piloted the aircraft. It was a strange kind of Christian paradox.
Okay, looking beyond your memories of that day, broadening our perspective, how do you think 9/11 has changed people as individuals and their perception of each other, particularly in the States, obviously?
Well, there are kind of concentric circles. Certainly for people who lost loved ones or friends in the disaster, it remains a very sort of visceral wound, a very tragic day. No New Yorker was untouched, who was in the city. Just living there, I think, was a very traumatic thing to go through. And then Americans, more broadly, I think, were affected, I would say, politically because of what came afterwards. One of the things that I lament is that in the days and weeks immediately following 9/11, there was this tremendous sense of national unity, and I think that was dissipated very quickly once the war began in Iraq. So what was this great sense of national purpose and unity and charity and a desire to help one another really disintegrated into, I would say, more political dissent.
So do you think that in a way the United States squandered that enormous goodwill that there was all around the world, or at any rate allowed the event to sharpen polarizations between opposing political forces?
Well, yes, I think they squandered two things. They squandered this great sense of national unity that sprang up after 9/11. That dissipated pretty quickly. And then once we invaded Iraq, there was an enormous dissipation of support for the United States. You remember, in the days after 9/11, you had all these government leaders saying, we're all Americans now, we're all on your side, and that left pretty quickly as well. So I think that any unity that we felt after 9/11 has really been squandered, and it's a shame because the first response of Americans was charity. And I think that those days were days of real grace for us, for Americans, and I think they left pretty quickly, unfortunately.
What, in your view, are the real lessons that should be learnt from 9/11?
That's a good question. Well, I'd like to look at it from a spiritual point of view, since I'm, not a politician or a political scientist. My experience at Ground Zero taught me that in times of great tragedy, there's always hope and there's always new life. One of the most amazing things that I saw down there was in the midst of this hell, this incredible sense of grace. I'd never been in a place where everyone was other-directed. I'd never really been in a community that had pulled together so much. So even in these times of tragedy, there was a sense of new life. And I kept thinking of the resurrection and this place, this sort of American Calvary, where we experience this great new life. And I also think at that time, God was offering us a kind of parable. When Jesus wanted to explain something complicated like the kingdom of God, he used simple stories drawn from everyday life and nature. And in a way, God was giving us a parable of his love in the story of the firefighters. So you could say, how much does God love us? God loves us as much as the firefighter that rushes into the burning building. So in a way, God was showing us his love that day in a very strange way because, you know, it came at a time of great tragedy. So it was a very difficult day and time. That's kind of an understatement. But by the same time, I feel that there are a lot of spiritual lessons to be learned if we reflect on it from a Christian point of view.
Okay, if we look at it more from a political or military point of view, of course, it led fairly quickly to the war in Afghanistan, for instance, which is still going on. I mean, do you feel that this is one of its most lasting legacies, you know, that 9/11 did lead to this?
I would say that's one of the lasting impacts. I would say that the war in Iraq was probably even more destructive. You could make a case for the war in Afghanistan because it was harboring Osama bin Laden, but it's harder to make a case, and even Pope John Paul was against the war in Iraq, which caused countless deaths and cost the American public trillions of dollars. So both of those wars together, I think, really took an opportunity of great concord and unity between the United States and other countries and within the United States and squandered them, I think. I mean, I'm all for appropriate defense, but I think, you know, going into Iraq, for example, that had nothing to do with 9/11, made no sense. And I thought that was a disastrous move with long-lasting consequences, both politically and also economically for the United States.
Okay, looking at it more from the point of view of an individual, do you think as individuals we've tended to lose our trust in each other? We tend to be more wary now of, particularly of, should we say, the Muslim community. Did it help to drive a wedge, or at least appear to drive a wedge between the Muslim world and the Christian world?
Well, on the one hand, you could make a case that it actually encouraged people to learn more about Islam. The number of books that came out and magazine articles that came out about Islam, the number of Muslim commentators that were on television and radio, I think, helped to educate people. But by the same token, I really do think that it just added to that terrible stereotype of the Islamic revolutionary or the Islamic terrorist. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think you speak to a lot of Americans, and that stereotype is unfortunately uppermost in their minds. It's very hard to eradicate. And I think that's, you know, of devastating consequences for the average American Muslim and frankly for Muslims across the world. So I think that was a very sad and unfortunate after effect of 9/11.
Okay, given that it's the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and this perhaps is one of the most disturbing thoughts of all, do you think or do you fear there could ever be another attack against the U.S. on the scale of the 9/11 attacks in 2001?
Sadly, I do. From all the articles I read, experts say that it's almost impossible to prevent a terrorist attack from someone who's sufficiently well-organized and sneaky enough and has the money. Certainly, the security has been amped up since 9/11. I was just in Israel a few weeks ago, and on both sides, Israel and the United States, there were tremendous security procedures. But there's all sorts of ways of having an attack. The difficulty, I think, for Americans is striking that balance between security and freely going about your day. But I think that's a task for pretty much everyone in the world today. It's a very sad commentary on what 9/11 has done, but it has made us both more suspicious and more jittery.
I was speaking to Father James Martin, Jesuit priest and author who works for America magazine. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English program. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.